You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing?
Hanging in there. A lot going on in the world.
There is a lot going on in the world. What a coincidence, because I wanted to talk to you about some of it. So first, let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Triolo, a consultant for starters. You're a partner at the Albright Stonebridge Group, if I've got those in the right order.
That's correct.
And you also now have a Substack newsletter, which everyone should check out, which is what, AI Stack Decrypted? Is that the name?
Yes.
You specialize in particular about tech that's related to China. And ostensibly, the story we're going to talk about today is not about China. But if you dig deeper, the controversy over this development is very much about China. It's all about China in the end, which is good for you. It's good business for you. Last week, during Trump's tour of the Middle East, it was announced that two countries, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, have pretty conceivably momentous agreements with the U.S. involving the building of huge data centers in both countries, for starters, which will involve the most advanced AI chips in the world made by NVIDIA, which is an American company, which is the reason we have some control over where these things get built. Also, some of the chips are AMD chips. And as I said, the controversy over this seems to largely involve China to the extent that I can tell. Why don't we start out by asking whether you think this is a big story. This is a momentous development. I'm kind of guessing that in a few years, something will happen and we'll say, yeah, it really does matter if these huge data centers are in the Middle East for one reason or another. Do you agree that this is a big story?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that there are some misconceptions around this issue. For example, the idea that the presence of advanced GPUs and data centers in the Middle East means that Middle East countries will be big players in developing AI rather than, say, deploying AI. So that's an important distinction, because the leading companies that are developing models and applications are all in the US, China, and sprinkled around other places like France. And maybe Israel, but very, very few other places. So it's not likely, in other words, that the mere presence of data centers, AI data centers, means that countries hosting those data centers have some great capability in AI. So I think that's a misconception. I hear people saying that, like, we're like, the US is outsourcing or transferring development of advanced AI models to the Middle East. That's not really the case. No.
Yeah. They did announce a new AI company called Humane, that's MAIN, in Saudi Arabia. But I take your point to be that if you look at the AI companies that are actually going to be training models on these data centers, they have names like OpenAI and Anthropic, presumably, and whatever.
Right. And others. And also, I think a lot of this infrastructure will most likely be used for so-called inference, which means, running those models after they've been trained. We're sort of in this world where we're going through this transition from roughly, say, 80-20 inference or 80-20 training to 80-20 inference terms of the capacity of compute that's deployed. Not surprising. That was always the plan, right? The training will continue, but the goal is to, make available more economically and more geographically dispersed capabilities, so that if you're a company in the Middle East running a complicated model or an application, you can serve that up on a local data center. It's very much more efficient. So that's sort of the broader goal. It's not really to have to have these countries become major players in developing those AI models.
Right. And just to dwell on the point you made for one second, the difference between training and inference, it's interesting because as really valued training centers, these have a very short shelf life, because in a couple of years, the cutting edge chip will no longer be the chips that are there, but they will still be useful for inference, for actually serving customers who are using the AI. So it sounds like then you agree that to the extent that this is important, maybe its importance is connected to China in one way or another, because you don't seem to think that the countries where these are located matters a ton. We should say, of course, Trump disposed of a Biden policy called diffusion that Biden had announced kind of on his way out the door, which imposed a pretty complicated set of restrictions on which countries could get our chips and I guess some of our chip making equipment. But it divided the world into three tiers. There were a relatively small number, like, I don't know, 10 or 12 that we really trusted. They got a pure green light kind of in terms of, importing our chips. And then there were the bad guys at the other end. Again, a small number, you can guess probably, but yeah, China, North Korea, Iran, Russia, I guess. And then in the middle, and a few other bad guys, but then a ton of countries that would kind of have to pass certain tests or something if they were going to get more than a certain number of chips. It was kind of complicated. Anyway, Trump threw all that out the window and said, here's the deal. Right now we're doing these huge deals with Saudi Arabia and UAE. They are huge deals. I mean, these would be the data centers envisioned, I think, are bigger than any existing data centers in the world right now. So they are big deals.
Still theoretical though, right? Like,
well, right. I mean, that's
you have to be careful there. Yeah.
Yeah, how solid is this? I mean, right now, there's not much contractually binding stuff yet. Is that the case?
Well, it's complicated. So first of all, this is not about semiconductor manufacturing equipment. It's just about GPUs.
The chips.
And the entire reason for doing the AI diffusion rule, of course, was the Middle East in the first place, right? So we have to go back to last summer, when this issue of this major investment and technology conglomerate G42 buying lots of these advanced GPUs led the Biden administration, in particular National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and then Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, to meet with senior officials of the UAE government and company, and tried to get them, for example, to promise to drop Chinese companies that they were invested in and not use Chinese equipment. So at that time, last summer, it was clear that governments and big sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East, like in UAE and Saudi Arabia, of the type that are now investing in some of these data centers, that they were eager to expand their footprint in this key emerging technology, in part to diversify away from oil, but also because they had lots of cheap energy. So they're also both those countries, for example, both the region are pursuing both renewable energy, of course, and then they also, of course, have access to lots of cheaper energy, fossil fuel based energy. So anyway, so the issue came up last summer, that led eventually in the fall to this idea that, oh gosh, you know, now we got to figure out a policy for how we allow countries to acquire this advanced capability to do AI training or inference. And so it's a little bit ironic that the Trump team did pull back this thing called the AI diffusion framework, which, as you rightly know, established these tiers, which nobody liked. Everybody hated the tiers, particularly the countries in the tier two hated it, like Poland and Israel,
which was most Saudi Arabia,
countries, yeah. UAE, right?
Yeah.
Everybody hated it. And then the industry didn't like aspects of it too, because, for example, it tried to mandate percentages of AI data center buildouts in certain places around the world, and it put elaborate compute caps on the amount of compute that could be acquired. So everybody hated the rule, basically, except for the people who conceived of it. So in any case, the Trump administration has pulled it back. Now, it will be replaced by something. So we have to be careful here It's not really rescinded in the sense that it's going to be replaced. And what it will be replaced with, we can talk about, but largely it came out of this trip. Some of the, that we got a little sense of what it was going to be, what it was going to, that would entail, basically bilateral agreements. And that's where the complication comes in terms of how solid this stuff is. Because basically Trump extracted these promises that these large, some of these large sovereign wealth funds will invest in U.S. infrastructure, right? Now that's a big difference from the Biden era, where there wasn't sort of a quid pro quo, or at least an officially stated quid pro quo. But here there's a quid pro quo. You invest big money in our data centers and some of our energy infrastructure to support those data centers, and then we will allow you in the form of these companies like Humane and also G42 and UAE to purchase these large numbers of GPUs. But all these deals have to still be go through, you know, be approved essentially in Washington. They have to go go through some licensing process, right? And then there probably has to be some formal bilateral agreement that spells out things like, okay, you're not going to allow these things to be diverted to China, or you're not going to allow customers in China or Chinese researchers to access these GPUs, right? Because that was sort of part of that, of those requirements in tier two, was some kind of agreement that would bind the recipient, if you will, with some responsibility to manage those. Because that's where a lot of the opposition in Congress and another China hawks in the administration came from, which was, hey, you know, these countries don't have export control regimes. They don't, you know, they may not be able to control the technology. They might, they're authoritarian regimes. Maybe they'll switch sides, right? Mm-hmm. And turn over all this stuff to the Chinese. So in any case, you know, this is, it's a little more complicated than at this point than Trump, you know, making these deals. They still are going to have to jump through some hoops going forward before, you know, ground starts breaking on some of these data centers. And there's some other issues we need to talk about too there.
Okay. So as for the argument about whether it's a good idea, as I said, it involves China. And if I could just make one contextual observation that might border on an editorial comment. When AI kind of, when this generation of AI, this generative AI based on deep learning kind of hit the world with GPT, I guess 3.5 originally, and got everybody's attention, there was a lot of talk, including by people like Sam Altman and about the need for international cooperation in regulating AI. And much when you discussed AI in an international context, it wasn't uncommon for that to be what you were talking about. It seems like now nobody talks about that. And whenever we're talking in America about AI in an international context, what we're talking about is China. That seems to be the driving concern, that there is now this imperative that's fairly widely accepted that we must, in some sense, win the AI race against China. It's cast as being of nearly existential importance. So anyway, this is another example of that, where these chips aren't going, you know, to China, but that is what this is about, right? And tell me, well, go ahead.
No, Bob, that's a great sort of step back comment here, and you're exactly right. So the existential risk around AI, ironically, have sort of switched from, you know, from the humanity to China, right? The existential risk is China. Now this is complicated, and I wouldn't say that nobody cares about this. I was in Paris for the so-called AI Action Summit, and that was previously these.
And by the way, the change of that name since the first one, which I think was called the AI Safety Summit or something, and they were held annually. And by round three, it's called the AI Action Summit, and it was largely AI boosterism. Now, I think you're about to tell me that there was some other stuff going on, and there were conversations, there was safety stuff. But go ahead.
There was safety stuff, and I was actually participated in the in a meeting where China announced the establishment of its so-called AI Safety Institute. The establishment of the so-called AI Safety Institute network was one of the big things that came out of the initial summit, which was held at Bletchley Park in the UK in November of 2023. And the whole idea there was to focus pretty narrowly on the most advanced models, so-called frontier AI models, and come up with a global framework for regulating them, precisely because of existential risk and other big risks around these models. And so, yes, the French sort of deflected the emphasis towards innovation and their companies and their ability to, mm-hmm. to help drive AI. But on the sidelines of that of Paris and some of the meetings that were shuffled a little bit to the sideline by the official organizers, there was a very robust AI safety discussion that continued. And then coming out of that, most importantly, there was a decision to keep the momentum going. And so I don't know if you've seen this, but you may want to talk to somebody about this. But in Singapore in late April, there was a conference, an AI safety conference. Max Tegmark, who's a mm-hmm. AI safety and very thoughtful guy. He was in Paris.
He's actually going to be on next week. Yeah. I've taped the podcast with him. We didn't dwell on that, but I mean, yeah, it's okay. A great Max conversation.
Max is great. Yeah. And Max was instrumental in organizing the Singapore meeting. And it was precisely because of this sort of loss of momentum coming out of Paris, right? And so, mm-hmm. We're in a situation where the bigger backdrop here to all this is that the progress on the technology is moving very rapidly. And so therefore the fear, if you will, of the AI safety community is also doesn't go away, right? It only gets worse, mm-hmm. right? Because as you see the capabilities of these models get better, as OpenAI, Sam Altman and others at places like Anthropic sort of hint that, we're getting close. We're getting close to something called artificial general intelligence. We're getting close to having super programmers, virtual programmers, where you can throw now a million software programmers at a problem. So in any case, that's sort of the bigger backup. So
in other words, you can replicate the AIs that are the programmers. Yeah.
You can have
copies
coders.
Of them.
So for example, coders, one of the big applications of these models is really advanced coding. And so in the last year, mm-hmm. we've gone from like the 1,000th best coder to like, in the top 50 coders, right, or below. So as the AI models get better and better at coding, then they can do a lot of,
And the singularity is near.
Right. Yeah. And that's basically what the leading labs are telling the U.S. government, right? And so that is also part of the idea that, mm-hmm. oh my God, we got to slow China down because we have to get there first, right? We can't allow China to have access to that kind of compute. Now, again, it's complicated because the premise of all this is so-called compute governance, which means controlling these GPUs, controlling China's access to computing. But that doesn't mean that the safety issue has gone away. And in fact, what's interesting is, and this is something that Max I think would support, is that the safety community, of course, is supportive of U.S.-China. Collaboration in this space, right? Because I think as we've spoken about before, I mean, basically the US and Chinese companies and then everybody else. And so if Chinese companies don't participate in this, then there's no way to get a global agreement, right?
Although I will say I'm trying to figure out the landscape of the AI safety community. It seems like most people who would say they're in that community favor the chip restrictions on China. I see a lot of that. And then some don't.
Most people. I'm not sure I would say most.
Well, that's a separate conversation. I could name several names of pretty well-known people. But so China, back to China. So I gather two of the main schools of thought on this deal, and tell me if these are the main two kind of opposing schools of thought, are... One seems to be, we're pulling these countries out of China's AI orbit or their AI stack orbit. I guess the premise being that they are highly valued, Saudi Arabia, UAE, because they have a lot of money, they have a lot of energy. And so I guess there's some value. I mean, as you said, the Biden administration, when they heard about this deal involving this company, whatever it was called, G42, that had some kind of connection to Huawei, that, they got involved and made sure that Microsoft got involved and we kind of pushed China out. So there's that. I gather some people defending the deal are saying, okay, it's just like the Cold War all over again, where you want these states to be in your orbit, your AI orbit, not China's. But then there are people who are saying, but wait a second, I think ultimately this stuff is going to somehow benefit China by leak. Maybe chips will be illicitly diverted that we think are going there, or maybe China will find a way to make use of the machines or something. Anyway, there is that kind of fear on the other side. Are those the two main sides of the argument? I'm not asking if you think either of them makes sense, but
those are two sides of several sides there. Two sides of the argument. So yeah, a lot of the pushback against the diffusion rule, for example, came from industry. Industry was basically saying, this is U.S. industry, right? They were saying the cloud providers and systems integrators and NVIDIA, you know, the companies that produce the actual hardware, their argument was, look, let the sort of market determine where the stuff is built. And we think our stuff is better. And so we need to make sure that countries are buying U.S. technology, and therefore they won't turn to China for that and Chinese companies for that technology. That's sort of the bigger picture. Yes, I think the diversion issue and the sort of smuggling issue, these are sort of distractions, right? I mean, it was funny. Jensen Huang from NVIDIA said something like this yesterday, that, you know, that these systems that NVIDIA is not producing, it's not a GPU that's you know, it's a two-ton system that they're shipping that has, you know, multiple dozens of GPUs in it, and hardware and cooling and networking. And he said, yeah, it's pretty hard to smuggle a two-ton system into China. You know, the smuggling and diversion issue is sort of a bigger issue. And actually, the same week that Trump made some of these deals, the U.S. Commerce Department put out some guidance, you know, to help companies to detect diversion. And then significantly, what they did also was say that the Huawei alternative, right? So the Huawei has alternative GPUs, right? They basically said that any of those most advanced GPUs, the 910, B, C, and D, were likely, although they didn't say for sure, produced in violation of U.S. export controls. So this was sort of the corollary of the deals was, hey, oh, by the way, if you're thinking of using Huawei hardware as an alternative, right, then you have to think you might run afoul of U.S. export controls. A pretty serious sort of, you know, extraterritorial threat, because and we can talk about this, there's no way for a company to determine on its own whether a particular semiconductor was manufactured or not in violation of U.S. export controls. It's way beyond their ability to do that. They'd have to hire somebody to tear down every one to determine that. Anyway, so that's the other piece is that the bigger goal of the way the Trump administration is going to approach this diffusion rule is do the bilateral deals, get some investment in the U.S., get some agreement on controlling the hardware, and also warn people that, oh, by the way, if you choose to try to go align with you with the China alternative, the China AI stack, as it were, and we can talk about what that includes, then you could run afoul of U.S. export control. We're not going to really tell you, you know, how that could be, because even the U.S. government does not know for sure which specific Huawei Ascend processors, for example, could have been manufactured in violation of U.S. export controls, because it's a complicated issue.
And can I ask you know, follow up on that a little? So the fear is that these countries will get enmeshed with China's AI stack rather than ours. For the time being, that's, in a certain sense, hypothetical, in the sense that only we have the most advanced chips. But as you know better than perhaps anybody, Huawei is catching up. Notwithstanding the restrictions that have been imposed on Huawei, in addition to the import restrictions that we impose on China for importing NVIDIA chips and so on, anyway, for now, any country that wanted to have a state of the art data center, they would go with NVIDIA chips and not with Huawei's. But let's assume that Huawei does keep catching up, and I think you're among the people who think that China is developing, coming closer and closer to having an indigenous capacity to manufacture even the most advanced AI chips. Let's assume that were the case. Can you sketch out exactly the fear? Okay, so what is it that happens if a country is enmeshed with China's AI stack rather than ours? Do you know what the specific scenarios are that these people play out? I mean, what bad thing happens?
Well, that requires another step back to sort of what the general concern is. So the issue, as you stated earlier, which we need to explore in a little bit more detail, it's a complicated issue, is the idea we're locked into now is that the goal is to get to artificial general intelligence first. And the reason for the controls on semiconductors is to ensure the U.S. gets there first. Now, why is that important? Well, it's interesting. If you look at my Substack, I did a critique of a very interesting podcast that Ben Buchanan, the former Biden White House AI czar, did with Ezra Klein 2 months ago. And in that, he was asked very specifically, what does the world look like if China gets there first, right? And so, you know, he gave a very interesting answer. He went immediately to the idea that China would deploy this advantage in the cyber domain and, you know, take down U.S. critical infrastructure. This was what he asserted, right, as the real reason. Now, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical that that's what the Chinese would do if they got to AGI first. It's not really, you know, it doesn't seem in keeping with the Chinese playbook, but that's, I think it's probably sort of a mirror imaging. If the U.S. gets to AGI first, what does the U.S. do with this, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very complicated and sort of unexamined issue, which is driving a lot of this. And it really comes down to what researchers have asserted is that the country that gets there first has what's called a decisive strategic advantage. I've written about this on my Substack. So that decisive strategic advantage means that that country and the company or companies, probably one company at that point that gets there first, can leverage that to make advanced weapon systems, advanced cyber capabilities. And then, you know, that will provide a sort of decisive strategic advantage. And then that country could then sort of lord it over the other, in this case, the other superpower, right? Whichever one gets there first. And so that's sort of the underlying thinking. Now, that's really complicated issue as to how we will know, you know, who gets there first and what will the other side think if they think the other side is getting there first, now that they know that the other side will lord it over them, you know, when the other side gets to AGI first. So anyway, that's sort of the bigger picture that here. But when you sort of get down to the issue,
can
of
I just interrupt and say one thing? Can I? I get the basic idea that whoever gets to AGI or superintelligence, whatever, wins. If you assume a highly adversarial relationship, which one wouldn't have to assume if one had a different foreign policy, but what I was actually asking about was this kind of smaller question of why it matters whether there are Huawei chips in Saudi Arabia. And I guess what you'd say is, for one thing, well, if a rich company like Saudi Arabia is buying a ton of Huawei chips, that stimulates the growth of Huawei, gives them more capital or something. Of course, one could equally well say, no, suck the Huawei chips out of China. That's where we're worried about doing the most harm, right? I don't know. Anyway, wasn't clear to me was this whole business of whose AI stack they're in. I understand the argument about who gets to AGI first. I guess the question about the AI stack is implicitly connected to the AGI question.
It would be something like if China's Huawei's AI stack is being used in other countries. First of all, the U.S. loses control of that country in terms of, you know, having it alive. U.S. on AI, whatever AI development or AI regulation. And then second, that would generate more revenue for Huawei to do more, to design more and better AI chips. And you know, that was sort of the argument of 5G, right? The 5G argument, again, sort of similar, right? The U.S. didn't want countries to deploy 5G. A lot of that was...
With Huawei equipment.
Right. The argument there was they could exploit the equipment for espionage purposes. Although, you know, that nobody talks about that anymore. But part of the argument in arguing against using Huawei equipment in Europe was to sort of undercut Huawei's business model. And a lot of the export controls, for example, you know, were targeting consumer devices like smartphones, and to undercut their revenue so they couldn't continue to develop R&D and couldn't continue to flourish. And so some of those arguments would likely be at play here in the case of Huawei aligning, other countries aligning with Huawei's AI stack. But it's a good question. It's not really very well. A lot of the fears here, if you will, are not really that well spelled out. No, nobody talks about 5G now, even though Germany's network is still has tons of Huawei equipment in it. Nobody, you know, the fears have now switched from 5G to AI, and largely, right?
And it's, I don't know, I'm not sure how consistent the different thinking is in different kind of domains of the same basic question. So like with Huawei, we said, we don't want you in our kind of smartphone software stack, you might say. We kicked them off the Android platform, and now they've started, now they've got their own operating system. They're actually doing very well as a smartphone company, and that platform will no doubt be appealing to some other people in other countries who might have otherwise been on the Android platform. Anyway, this is just an asterisk. It's just rarely clear to me what the logic is with these things. Because, and you know, one reason is there's such a consensus on the China issue broadly that you don't hear people's arguments challenged very often. They're not forced to get back to first principles. And so that's
They change, but the principles change over time. Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, I've written a lot about this, how the goalposts change, and particularly for industry. And then, yes, a lot of these, the justifications for some of these things, you know, aren't really very well examined. I would argue that the AI one falls into that, because the idea, for example, that we're going to get to some inflection point and you know, China could get ahead and develop advanced AI and then use it against us. You know, again, I'm a little skeptical that sort of dynamic would necessarily play out in the way some of the people think it would. And interestingly, you know, the CEO of Anthropic, Adair Amadei, has, if you haven't read and
Machines of Loving Grace, which has this section on why we have to squash China.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's careful not to say China, but it's authoritarian.
Well,
every time he says authoritarian,
he refers to an authoritarian bloc. I think we know who he's thinking of as the leader of that. And he says we have to secure and maintain dominance, including at one point he used the phrase military dominance, I think, until they like abandon their anti-democratic ways or something, and he doesn't specify what that would mean.
For me, I just reread it today, and his basic argument is we need to dominate so we can show China that we're dominant, and then they will change. They will change their system,
change their regime.
Which again, I mean, I'm sorry, but it seems to me a little bit naive to think that this is the case. And then, of course, you know, then there's the whole Taiwan issue too, which is at play here. So, but again, that's the kind of, and if you read that essay, any kind of geopolitical, you know, great power competition strategist is going to read that and go, okay, wow, you know, somebody's in for a rude awakening here if they think that China is going to, you know, is going to sort of, you know, bow down to U.S. AI dominance and say something, you know, and change the system. I mean, again, I don't see how we get to that situation.
Yeah, well, I think part of his stance may be defensive. He's worried. He wants to make sure that they can't dominate us with AI. And again, people really trace out what they're afraid of.
Right? Are they dominating us with 5G? Right.
This would be different. AI is going to be a more important technology than 5G, I'd say. Anyway, just sketching out their fear, I think. Right. I mean, one of the unexamined assumptions, I think, is that China would like to convert all other nations to its form of government or something.
There's no evidence of that.
I know there isn't, but I really think that's behind a lot of this. And so I think from Dario's point of view, it's like, well, okay, even if they never bow, you know, buckle and whatever he wants them to do by way of paying their respects to democracy, even if they never do that, at least they won't come, you know, turn us into their slaves, which I think is what he fears. Again, I agree with you. There's no evidence that that's their goal, but I think
there's no evidence that a Chinese government that realized that one of its companies had some advantage in the AI space would sort of immediately use that to sort of, you know, try to blackmail the U.S. to become communist. I mean, that's essentially what the U.S. side is asserting here, right? I mean, so anyway, I'm just skeptical that we thought through what it means to get to that everybody knows that we're at the state where one side is very dominant, and then what the political leadership of either country would do knowing they have this capability. Because most people talk about that as being temporary too. It would be so many months, then the Chinese would catch up. And so the debate around that, though, there isn't a whole lot of debate around that. It's sort of in certain circles within the US government and think tanks, that's just sort of accepted as, yes, we have to stop China, because if they get there first, their version of AI, whatever, or their decision to use AI will be bad. And therefore, you know, we can't take that chance. So that's sort of what's driving a lot of this. But again, I really think, and I agree with your view here if I'm characterizing you correctly, is, you know, that's, there's a lot of there's sort of a lot of unknowns there, and a lot of what I would call sort of almost cavalier treatment of how serious governments and serious political leadership would deal with a situation like this, right? I mean, this is not trivial. Yeah. There's a very good, if you haven't seen it, also this website called AI 2027, which is a very long and interesting read, but it plays out the scenario up to 2027, where essentially you get down to two companies, one on each side, supported by their governments, that are pursuing, you know, that and trying to get to that, to AGI. And again, I think there, the portrayal there of the, how the governments might react to that is it's well done. I mean, it's a very good attempt at this, but it really is sort of not necessarily well thought out in terms of, okay, was that really what would happen? So we're sort of in this weird world where we don't really know how AGI will manifest and how we'll know this, but we're making assumptions about how governments, you know, who recognize that we're there would react and how they would use that a certain capability, which we don't even, you know, we haven't really defined very carefully. So that's one of my sort of quibbles with, or, you know, major concerns with that. Because in the meantime, you know, there's all sorts of risks that we're entailing, like we're not going to have collaboration with the US and China. And then I've argued, as you know, in many cases, in many places, that, you know, if China believes that the US is nearing this and they're basing it, the hardware base is in Taiwan, you know, China, I think it's, again, naive to think that China's not going to take action on this, you know, sooner rather than later, force them to act on this.
No, this is, you were the first person I found, as you may recall, who had thought about this seriously. The fact that if you take the factories in Taiwan and cut off the flow of advanced AI chips to China, but keep the flow going to the West, that just alters China's incentive structure in terms of whether to invade Taiwan. I'm not saying it would be the only reason to invade, but it's clear how it plays out on the cost benefit side. And also,
if you listen again, go back to the Dario Amodei's essay, right? So in there, he says that he thinks his guess is that the current strategy of denial and export controls and all that is the best strategy. To ensure that the West or, you know, democracies get AI first. But then he's pretty clear there that the goal of that is so that they can basically use that capability to blackmail China into, you know, dropping the Communist Party, you know, or becoming a democracy. So again, if you're China and Chinese government and you see that, you know, here's the CEO of a leading U.S. company saying this, you know, what are you going to think? Right? I mean, it's a pretty big deal. Right. And I don't think people really appreciate the risks that you rightly point out. And I pointed out that, you know, I mean, if you're sitting back watching this, how do you, your calculus on something like Taiwan and its critical role and central role in the global supply chain, you know, you're going to, it's going to have an impact, right? You're not going to just blow it off. And Ben Buchanan in the former White House czar in that interview with Ezra Klein seemed to believe that, oh, well, China understands what the export controls are about, and they're not going to really, we should still be able to talk to them about safety and other things. And I'm like, again, I think that there's a lot of sort of misjudgment of China and the Chinese system and how it works and, you know, what's going on here, right? So I'm a little concerned that we're, you know, again, we're sort of sleepwalking into conflict based on these ideas that haven't been very, very closely examined, they were all thought out, and the collateral damage, you know, could be considerable. And just one other quick item. I just wrote a piece on this, but, you know, there's the rare earths too, right? Like in the next couple of weeks, we might see major companies in the U.S. have to shut down production because the Chinese cut off rare earths because of the export controls, right? So further collateral damage of the type that I've been talking about for some time on this. So anyway, so there's a huge sort of cost side to this. The benefits are at some future point when we may get to AGI, and then we may have some lead over China, and then we may, you know, do something with it, right? So that's the problem, is that there's these very different sort of costs and benefits that are out there, and then there are opportunity costs, right? Because, for example, we won't likely collaborate with China, or China will not see fit to collaborate with us on AI safety. And so then we're going to be not only in a race, but we're going to, you know, we're not going to probably know ultimately what China is doing in the space either. Just as at some point, probably U.S. companies like OpenAI and Anthropic will not be releasing their latest
model. Yeah.
They'll kind of go quiet because they're getting close to something. So anyway, so it sets up a very dangerous dynamic, in my view. The whole thing sets up a very dangerous dynamic that we're not quite in yet, but we're sort of in the middle. We're like in the first inning of a 9-inning game. And by the time we get to the 7th inning of this game, you know, people are going to be running for the exit.
And just to drive home something people may not realize in terms of danger, so all of the most advanced AI chips that OpenAI uses and so on, they're made in only one place, Taiwan. There isn't a second factory where NVIDIA makes these chips, okay? And Taiwan is, you may have noticed, is very close to China. China considers it part of Taiwan. And in fact, the U.S. doesn't even disagree. We don't recognize Taiwan as a sovereign nation. We have a one China policy, which means that, yeah, in some sense, they're part of the same polity. We just want them to work it out peacefully. And, you know, it had been the case that the fact that these factories are sending these great chips to China was a deterrent to invade, because the factories might get blown up. And obviously you care a hell of a lot less that they might get blown up if you're not getting the best chips. Does that, I want to quickly say one more thing on the cooperation front. You know, I remember a couple of years ago, Mustafa Suleiman, who is now, I guess, head of AI at Microsoft or something. He was one of the co-founders of Google DeepBrain. And he had, if that's, wait, no, I think there's a deep mind and a deep brain. Anyway, he was co-founder of what became the heart of Google's AI operation after Google acquired it. Anyway, he was saying, you know, I'm a skeptic of these export restrictions on chips to China, but if they work and, you know, we really play it well, and so China, in exchange for relaxing them, we do draw China into these cooperative arrangement or these rules of the road of AI. If they can really thread that needle, then okay, it would be worth it. Well, I would just say today, nobody even talks about that as a goal, right? It's all about you're restricting the chips so that we will win some struggle for planetary dominance and preserve freedom or something. And like, that's all I never hear anybody say that the price for us relaxing those restrictions would be doing what a lot of people think we actually need to do, which is establish these rules of the road and AI, maybe get more transparency into what's going on in China, you know, do those kinds of things. So that's that editorial.
And we did that, reminder, we did that with other advanced technologies, advanced weapons technologies like nuclear and chemical and, you know, biological weapons. The Chinese, we negotiated international agreements and the Chinese signed on to them, right? And so, yeah, so somehow AI is different. Again, the arguments that around why it is different are tricky and complicated, but it is a different technology, as I think you said earlier. But it's interesting how quickly we've gone from those leaders. Dario Amodei in 2017, I have a clip of it, of him that's linked on one of my Substacks, where he, in 2017, he was very much in that camp that said the US and China AI arms race would be bad for AI safety, because then you would not get. But now he's 180 degrees the other way, in part because of you know, the how far advanced we are since 2017, but also because of the geopolitical situation and how different it is in now than it was in 2017, when China wasn't, you know, sort of an the Washington consensus didn't treat China as an enemy, a political enemy, as it does mm-hmm. now. And so, you know, now we're and now these companies also need U.S. government support to build out some of this AI infrastructure. And so those companies, you know, naturally are going to more align with some of those consensus views and views in Washington around this idea of, you know, of slowing China down to get to make sure that the U.S. gets the decisive strategic advantage before China does. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very strange dynamic. Now, but getting back to the safety community, I think I would just say that you had indicated earlier that a lot of prominent safety people support the export controls. I would say it's a little more complicated. I don't think I think most of the safety, the really serious safety people support China's participation in a global dialogue. And that's, again, what happened in Singapore. There was a Chinese delegation there that participated. And, you know, Singapore and the UK, for example, both are sort of potential bridges between the US and China. Mm-hmm. Both believe that China should be part of this. That was the whole point of the Bletchley Park, the first conference, where China was invited. The U.S. was not supportive of China being invited. There was a sense that, well, the democracies should get their act together on AI safety, and then, you know, let in the authoritarians like China. But the U.K. did not agree with that, right? And also Singapore, I think, would support the participation of China and Chinese companies in this, because there's such important players here. So the safety community is a little more complicated than everybody believes that export controls are working. It's really the belief that China needs to participate. If that requires some relaxation of the export controls, then I think they would support that. But yeah, there are individuals that I could name also, who I won't, who are very much aligned with this idea of China as sort of the ultimate threat on AI. A lot of these people come from this effective altruism background too, which is another piece of this we haven't discussed, but that's important. A lot of this, the idea that effective altruism, the theory is, though, you know, to make sure that AI doesn't do bad things. A lot of that thinking, though, has switched from sort of malicious actors and existential threats from, you know, people misusing AI to China misusing AI, and China being sort of the ultimate bad actor.
So, okay, I want to talk about that more because, you know, a few of the people I think of in the safety community who are not China hawks and are on my side of this are actually EA people. So I would actually like to get into some name naming. You don't have to do any, but I'll name names on both sides of this argument as I see them. However, I will do that in overtime, which, as you know, is the section of our podcast that's available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. You can click a link in the show notes and become one, or go to the newsletter and become a paid subscriber. Before we go into overtime, I first of all want to mention your newsletter again, AI Stack Decrypted, and give you a chance to say anything you want to say by way of summing up. I mean, especially about this particular deal, because China is so much a part of the conversation about this particular deal that we kind of got off on China, like everyone else. And if there's something else you want to say about the Middle East deal, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's interesting that how this sort of came about. One of the big negotiators, apparently, in this, for example, was David Sachs, who was the mm-hmm. White House AI and crypto czar. Interestingly, David Sachs has these sort of he knows the industry very well. He knows the technology. So he has taken some interesting positions on this. So he's very much supportive of these deals. But on the other hand, he thinks some of the concerns, for example, about diversion are overblown. He also thinks that some of the concern about Huawei is overblown. So in the Saudi deal, for example, the Saudis wanted to put some of these GPUs in a facility that had Huawei equipment. And apparently the U.S. national security types were very upset about this. And David Sachs sort of said, you know, well, why are we worrying about that, right? Because the idea, again, that the Saudis would have to tear out all this Huawei equipment, because Huawei has built a lot of the Saudi telecommunications infrastructure, right? And also both Huawei and Alibaba and Tencent run data centers in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, right? So they're also there, right? So it's not those countries are free of Chinese technology. They're not. So anyway, so David Sachs is has sort of run afoul a bit of the national security types who were critical of this, and also Congress, right? Getting back to, you know, this may not be that easy to push all these deals through. There's going to be some congressional sort of kvetching on this, and then others within the administration who, you know, sort of national security China critics who will say, hey, wait a minute, you know, those original fears we had last summer about this haven't really gone away. And you know, if you're going to do this, then we're going to impose lots and lots of hoops that those companies have to jump through. So anyway, so there's a little more, you know, friction here before these actual data centers get built. But yeah, I mean, it's a big deal that the Trump administration does appear to sort of want to push this. And then again, the other key element here is this quid pro quo, which is some of those big investment, those sovereign wealth funds are going to have to invest in U.S. infrastructure, because part of the Trump, you know, priority is, of course, to build a lot of capability in the U.S. And that was even before this trip, of course, Stargate and all these other things. Stargate, interestingly, announced that they want to build a project in the UAE. So there is a little bit of, you know, sort of back and forth on this, where you invest in my infrastructure and I'll let you have, you know, GPUs and invest in your infrastructure. So it's a big deal. As I, you know, I don't want to play it down in the beginning, but again, the China angle, I think, is the most interesting part of it.
Yeah. Stargate is the project announced by Sam Altman at the White House. It involves SoftBank and so on. Not to be confused with Starlink. Okay. So thanks, everybody who's followed this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. That's where we're heading. Now I'm going to ask in overtime, before we head there, I'm going to follow up on the David Sachs thing, because I know you, he had a tweet that you were responding to, and he actually mentioned the effective altruism people in it. So I want to pursue that a little. I also want to ask if in some ways having these things in a region as volatile as the Middle East is a great idea. But anyway, we'll get to that. Thanks, everybody who stuck with us this far. We are heading into overtime.